Good morning. It's Saturday, April 13th, 2013. We are broadcasting live from Santa Cruz on the central coast of California. This is KUSP Public Radio 88.9 and KUSP.org. It is time now for Geek Speak.
We're through being cool. We're through being cool.
Please keep in mind that the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. Filling in for Lyle Troxell, I am your host, Miles Elam. With me in the studio is Bonnie Jean Primch.
Yep, that's me. I'm a broadcaster at large, mediator, and printmaker, according to this thing I'm looking at.
And in a moment, we'll be talking about one of those series of short, entertaining talks that have been a popular way for people to learn more about all kinds of stuff. This one is called Pecha Kucha, a format that originated in Japan and has spread internationally, including right here on the central coast of California, Santa Cruz. Santa Cruz organizers of a very geeky Pecha Kucha coming up next on Geek Speak. I'll introduce our guests for Pecha Kucha, and they are Margaret Rosas, the geek community cat herder and curator for this edition of Pecha Kucha.
Hello.
And Chip, co-organizer with Crystal Burns.
Chris Burns.
Crystal Burns of Pecha Kucha, Santa Cruz.
Yeah, so what is this Pecha Kucha? Aside from something very fun to say.
Pecha Kucha is, or Pecha Kucha, or there's a number of ways to say it, and I think that's one of the fun things about it.
Wait, no, but it's spelled in katakana. There's a particular way of... No.
So
what is... Japanese geek.
So Japanese geek, tell us what is the particular way.
No.
That's the whole thing.
I'm just going to dig myself into a hole where someone's going to email and go like, yeah, you totally got that wrong.
Well, you only have 20 seconds to tell us, though, what it is. That's how Pecha Kucha works. Basically, an architect firm in Japan 10 years ago, actually 10 years ago last month, called Klein Dytham Architects, started this format. And basically what it was born out of was long-winded architects.
They would get together. Trying to contain the architects.
Exactly. So the architects would present their projects, whatever they were doing, and hours would pass. And then the second architect would present.
And everyone would be asleep already.
Right. Yeah. So they came up with this format where they allowed each presenter to have 20 images in sequence that would auto advance every 20 seconds.
Like a PowerPoint.
A PowerPoint presentation that lasted exactly 6 minutes and 40 seconds.
Handy.
With exactly 20 slides.
Okay.
And the format caught on. It expanded to designers. It expanded to whomever. And now it's, as Miles mentioned, it's sort of an international phenomenon. It's now 10 years later, since over 600 cities in the United States, there's several, and it's all over the world. Yeah. It's really, really fun. And it's expanded much beyond, you know, just architect and design. It's, you know, there's a great website that they have, the Pecha Kucha Global site, that has many, many presentations. And you'll see everything from, you know, somebody talking about a cheesecake recipe that they're really excited about to, you know, some of the most innovative, exciting, you know, breakthroughs in science.
And I saw one, was it like a guy had a very humble little apartment, I think in Japan, and he inherited it from his dad or something. And over time, he has done so many things to this apartment to make it like a transformer apartment, basically.
Right, yeah.
And so you get to see sort of all the different ways that he, you know, you just move this wall here and suddenly, pada, you got a kitchen. Or, let's go to heaven. You know,
yeah.
Like amazing.
No, and there's also, I think one of the things that drew me to, I had heard about the format and the event and similar formats for a long time. And then I ended up at an event over in San Jose at a conference on placemaking. And the morning session was a Pecha Kucha format. And there were a lot of presenters. And what really struck me about it, relative to Santa Cruz and our community here, is there, it's a really snippet, it's a short insight into something that somebody's really either knowledgeable or, more importantly, really excited about.
Right.
And we have such an incredible diverse community with people who have such a range of interests.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not going to go up to a 2-hour lecture at the university on something unless I'm really interested in it.
Mm-hmm.
Or I should say, unless I know that I'm really interested.
Unless you
in
know
it.
That you're really interested.
Right.
In it. So this like attending a pitch a kucha then becomes like starting a Pandora channel or something.
Exactly.
Where you're
exactly.
like, oh, there's something in here that's interesting, and then you get exposed right. to all these things that you would not have had a
sure.
chance to find out about.
Yeah. And we've been this is our third one locally in Santa Cruz. We started last November. We had one at Motive downtown.
Mm-hmm.
And I should say another very important component, it's usually accompanied by beer.
Oh.
Or some other.
So the
activity.
One I attended at the Museum Social of Art and History was an anomaly in that way.
I think there was, didn't they have beer there?
We at the breaks.
At the breaks, right.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think that's, you know, it's a very casual environment,
right.
really, is
yeah.
is what the point. So we had the second one at the Museum of Art and History. We had some really great presenters there. And it's, you attended that and
I did.
Probably saw something or heard something of interest that you wouldn't have sought out.
A few things, yeah.
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 So, and that's, to me, what was exciting about it. There's so many cool, interesting people doing amazing things or just really excited about certain things. And I can absolutely tolerate 6 minutes and 40 seconds of them
right?
telling me about what they're excited about.
Well, that's one thing, Chip, but why did you want to be an organizer of these kind of events? Why did you want to be an instigator in having this happen
you
on
know,
the Central
I,
Coast?
I actually... That's a good question. And Crystal Burns, actually, when I thought about doing this, right after I got really excited about doing this and talked to Mike at Pitt at the Motive about, you know, booking the space, and mm-hmm. he said, yeah, I'd love to have it here. Literally, like, the next day, Crystal Burns said, I'm talking to the museum about doing a Picha Cucha Night in Santa Cruz. Have you ever heard of Picha Cucha Night?
Like, we have a series.
And it's like, well, actually, that's funny you say that. And Crystal and I have... you know, worked on a lot of projects together. We've,
uh-huh.
we've done a lot. So it's been really fun to... but to answer your question, why did I want to do this?
Right.
I don't. I want somebody else to do it. But it's a really great... I just want it to happen.
Right.
So
it works
and
out for you that
yeah.
you have guest curators
yeah.
every time.
And,
is that true?
And not only does it... Like, the first one at Motive was, in a lot of ways, a lot of my friends.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
And I...
The first one's easier.
Part of the format, the appeal of the format, it isn't insular.
Yeah.
It's not, you know, it's reaching out to communities. There's a lot of cross-germination.
Right.
And I know a lot of people, but, you know, my hope is that, and I think a lot of the way that the Picha Cuchas in other cities have been successful is a lot of different people, you know, organize it.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not a real controlled organization. It's like, let's just pick a date, find some people to present.
Who wants to come
get
play.
A projector and some PowerPoint.
Yeah.
And have some beer.
Right, right, right.
Yeah.
So this time you've been doing a series now. This is the third one coming up.
Right.
And a different curator each time?
Well,
right?
we've had a different theme. The first one, I guess appropriately, was introductions.
Yeah.
We had a theme of introductions at Motive, and we had some really fun, exciting presentations. One that stood out, Bryn Loosely, who's a... not only an incredible middle school teacher here in Santa Cruz, but he's a great musician, did a performance, really, with his 20-second slides about musical
that's cool.
musical introductions. And within his presentation, he actually built in a quiz show. And he played guitar on stage during his presentation and timed it perfectly to his slides. And it was really...
It takes planning.
Yeah, it was really well done.
Yeah.
And... you know, and then Kim Luke, who you may know is the voice of the Warriors and Millie Fierce at the Derby game. She did a really great one. Actually, at the end of one, she did a presentation on the several presentations that she thought about doing but couldn't put together.
Oh, that's adorable.
So then the second one, the museum worked with us and curated, and it was the theme was tied into their works in progress theme at the museum.
Very tidy, yeah.
And so now in moving to the second one, we said we need somebody else to bring in a new community.
Right.
And we found somebody really cool.
Well, and this is where Margaret Roses comes in. You're curating this time.
That's right.
Yes.
I'm curating.
And did you set the theme also, or did you decide together with Crystal and Chip what the theme would be?
I did. Well, they asked me, they said, you know, you can pick the theme, you can see what you want to do. And for me, I'd heard about Picha Cucha Nights forever.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had long wanted to do one, kind of like they had, but never actually organized one. But I just thought it would be a really fun format. So when they asked me to curate one, I was like, this is fantastic, because I heard the geeks in Santa Cruz through the Santa Cruz Geeks. And so I've I know a lot of the geeks in town. And so that was really the theme that was near and dear to my heart, was to really look at this kind of movement of being, or identity of being a geek and what that means. And people often think it's a technology thing, but...
I'm learning more in the show as these more technological geeks have accepted me into their fold, that it could be people geeking out about anything.
That's right.
Yeah.
And that's really what this is here to show. And we added, I made a geek obsession at a suggestion of my daughter, who thought it needed explanation.
Yeah.
She's like, oh, but you don't mean geeks. You mean people who are really obsessed or passionate about things, and they have like an obsession. And so that's really what we're doing is we're...
Nice.
Well, that is what a geek is. Hack the planet.
Hack the planet.
Hack the planet. Figure it all out. Make it go.
It's like whatever it is, you know, and it often happens to be technology, but it can be beer. It can be science. It can be water.
So in the 3 minutes that we have left, not a lot of time, but can you give us a preview of some of the things that are coming up? And when is the next Pecha Kucha, by the way?
Okay, so it's Thursday, April 25th at 6 p.m. at Pono Hawaiian Grill, downtown Santa Cruz.
Downtown Santa Cruz. It's on Union Street.
That's correct.
Okay, and people can go to the Pecha Kucha Santa Cruz site or to the Facebook page and get the particulars of where and how to get there and all
exactly.
that stuff. All right, so who's coming?
So we've got a great lineup. What I like to call it, it's a cast of characters, right? So we assembled a cast of characters. We have Chris Miller, who's an entrepreneur and consummate, I'm going to say that a lot, consummate, I think, but beer geek. He is very... he's a homebrew guy who's trying to make it, bring technology to it. So he's going to tell us.
Every time he mentions the word beer, everyone has to take a drink.
That's right.
Okay. What else?
We'll make him go first.
Yeah. Yeah, that's good. Get him in the mood.
We've got a cultural anthropologist who often tells me more about myself than ever about him. So I'm excited to get him up on stage so that
so he could just talk about you up there.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. He's going to talk about everybody in the audience, but he's an observer. And so
an astute individual.
And a very astute individual who does R&D for a place in the Silicon Valley. So super smart guy.
Okay.
We've got Conrad Altman, who is a font geek. And is
font
likely,
geeks are geeks.
Yeah.
They get way into it. That's
way
in
into
detail.
It. That's like...
Where did the little serifs go?
Oh my gosh!
Oh no! No!
You
not
say
just where, not just where the serifs go. We're talking about how does the curve react when it gets twice as small? What about if it's 15% smaller? What about it? Yeah.
Yeah. You can't just auto space everything. You have to kind of account for the curvature of some.
Yeah.
Of
among
letters.
Designers,
we
font designers
you
are black
art.
Yeah.
I think that everybody's going to find that they're all a geek about something.
Yep.
They're like, wow, that's me. Conrad has a great story. I hope we get to hear that night. He's had some interesting things happen. So we have a serial overshare, and by night, web developer by day, Rob Knight, who's going to be sharing something spectacular. I just know he's a funny man and a funny man to watch on social media. So he'll be fun to see what he does in 6 minutes.
Delightful. Well, that's a good preview.
Yeah.
So where let's just go over again where people can find out more to show up for Pecha Kucha.
So if you're a Facebook fan, you can go to Facebook, search Pecha Kucha.
Okay. And it's P-E-C-H-A, new word, K-U-C-H-A, in the English.
In English, that's
right.
Correct.
Okay.
Pecha Kucha, and there's a Pecha Kucha Santa Cruz page.
Okay.
And there's also PechaKucha.org.
PechaKucha.org is the global site, and you can very easily...
You've got a
easily,
Santa Cruz presence on that site. We'll link to it at geekspeak.org,
right.
So you can find those things there, too.
Yes, and we'll be... So you'll get more information if you go to our website, and you can find out more about things like, the IRS looking at your emails without a warrant.
Well, we're going to talk about that next, right? That's coming up on
Well, that's coming up later, yeah.
Later on Geekspeak.
Yes.
Okay, good.
But for now, and that will come up in the second half of
the
show.
All right.
So, you want to take a phone call.
Well, we're just getting one now. We're just getting fresh word that David from outside of Boston, Massachusetts, is calling us. And he's got a question about programming languages. And he's on line one, I believe.
I don't see anyone on line one. I see one on line four. So let me try that one.
All right, we'll try that. We'll see what happens. Nope.
Nope.
All right. So why don't we get to that in a moment once we figure out where for sure he is.
Hello, are you there? Nope. Okay.
All right, we're going to wait on a minute on that one. So you've prepared a number of stories, things going on in the geeky news.
Indeed, I have. And we'll start off with some basic items, like, for example, an FDA-approved piece of software for an iPhone-based vision test.
Oh. What? Now, an iPhone-based vision test.
Yes.
We're talking about doing diagnostics from your new friend, the smartphone.
Yeah. iPhones and other smartphones, actually, have the screens have become so good that from your typical viewing distance of, you know, about a foot away from your face or so, even people with great vision can't really tell the difference if it gets, even if you had a higher resolution display.
Okay.
We're about at the limits of what the retina can perceive, which is why they're called retina displays.
Uh-huh.
There is some marketing involved in that, but that's generally the case. So they end up being very useful for vision tests. Now, to go in for, if you suffer from something like macular degeneration or some similar degenerative eye disease, then you do need to go to a doctor and get checked out. However, to keep track of it, it's really hard for you to tell when your eyes are starting to go get worse.
Right.
It's really hard to tell that. For any of you who have glasses, you know that as well, that if you're looking around, you're like, oh, it might be a little bit off. I don't know. Then you go to the eye doctor in 2 years or something like that, and they put the new lenses on. You know, does this one look better or does this one look better?
Yeah, Avery, that's kind of fun, though.
Right.
I don't want to miss out on getting
right, but at
the
same time, you go like,
machine.
Oh, my God. It was so much better.
Right.
Like you realize that your prescription has changed so much, but it was such a gradual change, you couldn't really keep track of it very well.
Okay. So here's what I don't get. Does your iPhone have some sort of retina scanner on it that's creeping me out?
No. The idea is that you have this test and you're able to, and you answer questions.
A or B,
you,
B, C.
And you're able to, you look at it and what you can read, that's going to be your response to it. So you can see an actual comparison between your performance from yesterday, your performance today, your performance next week.
Okay.
And so it allows you to track it without having the expense and the time taken to go to see the eye doctor for every little thing, especially if you aren't degenerating that quickly. It'd be nice to know that.
So for people who are running out of things to obsess about, here's an option, right? You can just,
if you're
instead
obs-
of looking
if you're
for
going
the
to,
time, you can just check your vision.
If you're going
now?
To obsess about something, your vision is not a bad thing, because if your vision starts to degrade very rapidly in a short period of time, you want to get that checked out as quickly as possible.
Okay. So maybe not for everybody, but for people who have a particular concern about if their
right.
vision's
right. This is someone who your vision is going to be deteriorating rapidly,
yeah.
Or at least much more rapidly than the typical individual, even someone who has a visual impairment like ourselves. We both wear glasses.
Hi, we both wear glasses. That's how you know we're geeks.
So yeah, that's
all right.
That's,
so is that coming up? Is that out on the market? Is that an app I could get right now?
I actually don't know that.
Okay.
It has been FDA approved though, so I'm assuming that.
So we should just keep our eye out. For
I'm assuming that the FDA approval is something that has taken a while, and the company has been like, "Yeah, we're gonna." Software distribution doesn't take very long these days. So.
Right. True enough. True enough.
So
right.
I would assume it would be the amount of time it takes for Apple to say, "Yeah, okay, this can go up." And
all right. Okay, so something to look out for there. So let's try David again on line one. He's got an old mainframe programmer, or that's who he is. He's got Corn Shell, Oracle, SQL, and he's looking for recommendations for a new language for application development.
Hello, David. Are you on the line? Can you hear us?
Yes.
Wonderful.
Up.
Wait, hold on.
Hold
on just one moment, as I apparently don't have coming through your headphones.
No,
Bonnie?
He's just super faint. Just turn him up.
Okay. How's this? Try again.
Can you hear me now?
Sure.
Yeah, or try to speak up into your... we'll try to pick up the gain a little bit more, but go on.
Okay. Well, thank you for taking my call.
As
of course. I said, I'm an old mainframe programmer from many years ago.
The people involved with having all of us make so much money on the Y2K bug.
He knows about punch cards, I bet.
I made quite a bit on it myself.
Nice. Well, yeah, I would imagine so, that you know mainframe programming.
Right. Anyway, I made the transition many years ago to be a database administrator. I've been working with Oracle for about 15 years. And I do Corn Shell programming on AIX, Solaris, and Linux.
Okay. Corn Shell, just... corn shell being a shell, just like if you go onto a Mac and you open up the terminal, that's a born-again shell, a bash shell. So a corn shell is just correct. A different variation of that. A very well-adapted to programming variation, if memory serves.
Yes, it is. And I do some Windows batch programming as well, mainly for writing scripts to automate database jobs. Mm-hmm. However, I do have other ideas for products that I'd like to do to make my own life easier. And I know that in the past you guys have said that an idea that you don't necessarily work on yourself is worth probably about 25 cents. And I want to start developing some of these things.
Good. Yes,
what
good.
I'm looking for is a programming language that I can pick up fairly easily that has the ability to interface with a database and that can... work with a server on a server environment and on a standalone Windows or desktop environment.
Okay, so you want to make
what your recommendations are.
So you want to make a graphical user interface, a client application as well.
Absolutely.
Okay. Well,
searching. Please hold.
With regard to talking to a database, there are very few programming languages in popular use these days that can't talk to a database. So you're pretty well covered there, especially with regard to Oracle. Everyone has some driver that can talk to Oracle. Beyond that, let's see, an easy-to-use programming language. One thing that comes immediately to mind is Python, in that it is extremely easy to use. It is very consistent.
And easy to pick up, that seems to be a consideration.
Yeah, it's very easy to learn. With regard to...
How does that compare with, say, Ruby?
They have very many similarities. It's hard for me to describe over the air, but I would put Ruby as closer to a cleaned-up Perl, an object-oriented Perl. Or object-oriented Perl with a cleaner syntax. Python, hard for me to really describe it. The fact that you're coming from a scripting language background also makes me want to lean toward Python in that it has significant white space. Makes it easier to keep track of the flow of the program. In other words, the indentation is mandatory.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always found, especially with people who are just beginning, that is a major concern when you have programming languages like most other ones, that you are bound by curly braces or the like.
Sort of easy to tell what's going on.
Well, with the curly braces, you end up with people wanting to do things on one line and sometimes not. You forget to indent, so you have a hard time following what the program flow is and where variables are scoped.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like the programming language itself is kind of in an outline form.
Yes.
Got it.
And so, I mean, if I was going to make a suggestion, that would be the one that I'd give. You'll need to interface with a graphical user interface language or a toolkit, and there are a few available for it. Fortunately, I'm not as well versed in that area, mostly web development these days.
Well, we could ask the other geeks, right? David, if you wanted to write geeks@geekspeak.org with that question, we can get the rest of the geeks weighing in also.
Right. And another option would be Java, because that has its graphical user toolkit built into it. Are you planning on distributing this?
At first, it'll be used just for my own work use, but if things work well, then maybe I would. So okay. I'm also interested in whether these things are compilable.
Yes, they are. You can compile a Python program into an executable for distribution later. Basically, it bundles with the interpreter, and it runs by someone double-clicking an icon. So that wouldn't be a problem. Okay. That's the case with a lot of things these days.
Well, thank you very much for your opinions. I appreciate it very much.
Yeah, and both Python and Ruby are great choices. If I had to choose between the two, I would say Python. But yeah, good luck, and let us know how it goes.
Will do. Thank you.
Thanks for calling, David. So, Miles, earlier you were telling me that there's Energy Star has now come out with the first LED light bulb, and I'm confused because I thought LEDs were supposed to be energy efficient already anyway.
Which they are.
So what?
One of the things that has been a problem with compact fluorescence, we're talking about a different technology than LEDs, but we're going to give some background here.
All right, background.
With compact fluorescence, if you've ever bought one, you know that there's a very wide range in quality level. Some of them work like advertised. In other words, I put a compact fluorescent on my porch light, and that thing has been working for several years and hasn't had a problem.
All right.
But at the same time, I've also bought compact fluorescents that have died within a couple of months.
And is that about manufacturing, or is it something inherent in the nature of fluorescence?
No, it's manufacturing. Okay. It's manufacturing quality.
All right.
And to get past that problem, regulators have tried to mix in not just the energy efficiency and the light output, but also the longevity, the expected longevity of it, given the components in it. So what they've done is they would take a light bulb sample, an LED light bulb sample, and these things are supposed to last for 20,000 hours, rated for that. I mean, a very long period of time.
That's a long period
years
of time.
Years and years and decades.
Legitimately a long period of time,
And what they'll do is they'll set it up in their environment and have it running and alternating on and off and other things for 9 months. And it depends upon what applications are doing.
Keep it on for 9 months. It's a good test.
Because they consider an LED light bulb to be burnt out, the equivalent of burnt out, if it only emits 70% of what it, of light that it emits when you first bought it.
But it's still emitting light.
It's still, two-thirds of the light that it's giving. But,
okay.
But that's when they consider their cutoff. So when they measure it for 9 months, they basically extrapolate from there what has been the drop-off from that point and extrapolate what would be the drop-off after that. And so do they meet the longevity requirements?
Ah, okay. Does it still actually functioning as a light source after 20,000 hours?
Right.
Okay.
And LED manufacturers, because this is a time-consuming process, obviously.
Sounds like it.
Haven't necessarily gone through it, but also there have been a lot of manufacturers that have jumped on the market where the LED light bulbs have not been lasting as long as they should be.
Oh. So we haven't seen them on the market yet because of the amount of time it takes to test and make sure that it'll work?
The Energy Star labeled ones. We've seen LED light bulbs on the market, but not the Energy Star.
Oh, it's just the label.
Right. And so if you see an LED light bulb that is Energy Star certified, that means not only that it will give a certain amount of light per the watt. When it says 100 watts, it'll give at least 1600 lumens, that type of thing. Mm-hmm. And also that it will be within a certain level of efficiency, like for example, 20 watts to give 100 watts of luminosity.
Right. So it has to be energy efficient. It has to meet the standards of an amount of light.
Right, or the equivalent of an incandescent,
okay, and it has to last a certain amount of time?
And it has to last to a reasonable amount of time. In other words, if someone's paying, 30, 40 bucks for this light bulb, which is what they cost right now.
You want that to last.
You want that to last. You're fine with that cost being amortized over the length.
That's a reasonable concern.
Yeah, over time, but you want that length of time to actually be there.
So they finally figured it out.
It's finally being implemented, and someone has gone through the process, and now there are actually light bulbs available that you can buy that will have a certification that they will last a certain period of time.
Have you seen them? What do they look like? Is it just like a little tiny LED, or is it a cluster of them
They range in shape depending upon what fixture they're going into, but the common ones, they have the shape that you would expect from an incandescent.
Okay.
In other words, they have a globe and they have a taper.
And they screw in like that.
And they screw in. Except that the part just next to the screw part, but below the globe, ends up fanning out in a triangular shape. It has these fins on it.
Oh.
What that is a heat sink, because LEDs are very susceptible to heat.
It also makes it look more like the future.
It also makes it look like the future. But it ends up looking like a CPU heatsink in many ways.
And what about the quality of light? Have you checked it out? Like some people go, fluorescence that was is actually nice another efficient, but ugh, the light.
I actually neglected. That was another part of the story. That's one of the things they were testing as well, that the light ends up being a certain hue.
Uh-huh. Because we like them when they're a little warm, don't we?
Yes, we do.
We do. All right. So that's the first Energy Star LED light bulb available now. Check for it in stores.
Yes. And check for the Energy Star logo, which will be showing up far more often.
Okay.
Now.
All right. It's a good way to go. Even though those filament bulbs sure look cool.
And I'm sure sooner or later someone will make an LED bulb that emulates the look and feel of an incandescent.
Right. Right.
Well, other than the heat, hopefully. But
hey, I heard Microsoft put out a patch, and the patch needs a patch or something. What's going
yes.
on? What's going on?
Windows 7, Microsoft put out a patch, which they regularly do mm-hmm. for vulnerabilities or, you know, fixes, things like that. Unfortunately, this patch made it so that some people's computers couldn't boot anymore.
Wah, wah.
And so Microsoft is telling people to uninstall it. Now, the question comes like, wait a second. If people are having problems booting at their computer, how do
they
uninstall
it?
The answer is that you would start it up into safe mode.
Okay. So if you're having problems, start up in safe mode and see if you can find the thing and uninstall the thing.
Yeah, add remove programs and remove that. And there are instructions on Microsoft's website, which would be difficult if you don't have a computer to work with. So borrow a friend's computer or look up on your cell phone or
use it on
tablet.
Your new friend, yeah. The smartphone. Oh my gosh. Hey, we have time for another quick one before we go to our break. Miles, what do you want to talk about?
I want to talk about how Windows XP, the bane of my existence, is no longer going to be supported by Microsoft come April 8th, 2014.
So is that Ding Dong, the witch is dead? What's going on?
The reason being, and this is purely self-serving on my part, with regard to web developers, one of the reasons why people still use Internet Explorer 8 and earlier mm-hmm. is because they can't update to a newer version of Internet Explorer.
Oh.
Because XP only supports Internet Explorer 8, and that's their cutoff. Oh. Vista went to Internet Explorer 9, and Windows 7 can go up to Internet Explorer 10.
Okay.
Most people have skipped Vista and gone straight from XP to 7, but there's still a bunch of people that are holding out on XP.
What's up?
Now, well, but then again, if you use a different browser, you're not our problem. But if right. you upgrade to Windows 7, you probably won't have Internet Explorer 8, and people like me won't have to support it anymore. And that will be a wonderful public service to the web developers of the world.
You're excited as a web developer not to have to keep pulling some of these old programs up by the bootstraps.
Yes.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Congratulations. Congratulations on this during this exciting time. Hey, there's going to be another great show tomorrow at noon here on KUS. There's plenty of fantastic shows between now and noon. If you want, you could just kind of like keep the radio tuned all through the weekend. And just so you know, when you're listening to it Sunday at noon, we're going to hear the 7th Avenue Project. This time we spend much or most of our lives creating, telling, and consuming stories. Maybe this storytelling instinct is part of what makes us human. Writer Jonathan Gottschall thinks so. He says we are storytelling animals and describes some theories on why this is so with KUSP's Robert Polly. That's the 7th Avenue Project, Sundays at noon or anytime you like at our website, KUSP.org.
And it's always a great show. Robert guest hosted Geek Speak once and it was a wonderful show, made us all look bad.
he phoned us.
You are listening to Geek Speak on 88.9 KUSP and KUSP.org. I'm your host, Miles Elam, with the unimpeachable Bonnie Jean Primm.
You can't get rid of me. Hey, we've got another call, Miles. You want to take one?
Well, first I want to do a geek bit. Since
all right.
We're at the just
a geek
past
bit.
The
These
point.
Are things that you have to see to really appreciate.
Right. Up on the website after the show, I'm going to be posting a link to the ability to visualize 7 billion people. I mean, it's kind of like astrophysics. Their numbers are so big, the human mind just cannot wrap themselves around it. Like the amount of space in one light year, let alone when someone talks about 1.3 million light years
yeah,
or something
million,
like that.
Billion, no, it's just
right.
kind of crazy.
So how do you visualize 7 billion people? Well, this website will show you how. It has the icon of one person, and then you have to scroll until you finish scrolling till you get through 7 billion people, and it tags how many are in the different continents, how many in Asia, how many in Africa, how many in the Americas, how many in Oceania. And
so how big a screen would you need to really appreciate?
It's quite possibly the largest web page I have ever seen.
Wow.
And I've seen some large ones, especially ones that are talking about astronomy.
Right, right. All right. So we're after the show, we're going to put that up on geekspeak.org, and you'll be able to scroll to your little heart's content to be wowed by the number of people that we currently are in this world.
Yes.
All right. So we've got a couple calls. First from Hal in Santa Cruz. He's got a comment about LEDs and a question about Windows 7.
Hal, you on the show. You're on the air.
In theory.
Hello, Hal.
Hello.
There we go. That user error.
I hear you guys, but you pressed the wrong button. Hello?
No, I didn't press the wrong button.
Well,
I just didn't hang up on
one button at once. What's
there
that?
We go. Yeah, I just forgot to drop the last call.
Hi, Hal.
Okay, thanks, Miles. First, I wanted to thank Bonnie for raising the question of light quality on the LEDs, because that was a big barrier to the adoption of the compact fluorescents.
Yeah.
People said, oh, I don't like the color. And in fact, there's the full range of colors available, and it's indicated on the light bulb packaging in terms of the color temperature. So in degrees Fahrenheit, basically, maybe it's degrees centigrade. So you actually can pick the color temperature. And the same issue has arisen with the LEDs, and I think people need to be aware when they look at the packaging that they have a choice about the color temperature. And as Bonnie Jean said, you know, we tend to like the warmer lights, not the cooler lights.
Right, so, and also with compact fluorescence, in that same vein, compact fluorescence, many of them, especially the poorer quality, cheaper ones, will take a long time to actually give you the light that you're asking for. It's this nice dim and goes up, which is nice actually for a bedroom light.
Yeah,
because it's you turn it on, you're not blinded.
Yeah,
but
it's a gentle way to get the light
well,
going.
I have some of each. I have some that go on immediately and some that take time. And you're right. That's not something you can find out by looking at the package.
Some of the packages actually do say they're a quick on. That is a nice indicator. But then again, it's manufacturer driven rather than something that's an objective.
It's like saying all natural ingredients.
There are two other things. One about the compact fluorescence is some are dimmable and some are not. And a lot of people like to have a dimmer so that they can pick the intensity of the light. And so you might want your lights on brighter when you're working at your dining table like I do, and a little dimmer when, you know,
you're wooing someone at the dining table.
What's that? I didn't hear you.
A little dimmer when you're wooing someone at the dining table.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
That was the romantic dinner. So that's another issue. And I've only purchased a couple of LEDs, but I got a whole fixture with the LEDs incorporated at Home Depot, and the whole price was less than what you guys stated for the for a single LED bulb. And it's dimmable. It's very nice. It's a little bit on the cool side, but it's dimmable, and that's a big advantage for the fixture where I have it. So that was the series of comments on the light bulbs. A question on Windows 7. My Windows 7 machine has stopped being willing to start again after it goes to sleep. And this is recent. And I was wondering if that might be from the patch that you guys were mentioning and whether if I start in safe mode, I'm going to be able to deal with that.
Since you applied the patch, it stops going to sleep? Or just in general?
I'm sorry, say it again.
Since you applied the patch, like did you apply the patch or... has it just been something that's happened in the last month or so?
It's actually only been a couple of weeks. I don't know if I applied the patch to.
Okay.
I tend to download and install all updates.
Okay, so it's not related to this patch then, because if it were this patch, it would have the patch was only released on Tuesday. So if it's older than Tuesday, the problem is older than Tuesday. It's something else that's an issue.
It might actually have been about Tuesday when it first happened. Yeah. So.
Well, you can always try. Well, the thing is, you can use your computer. You can boot in, so you don't have to reboot into safe mode to get rid of it. You can actually just go in and remove that patch normally. The safe mode was only necessary for people that couldn't boot their computers otherwise.
Okay, but you were saying that they've issued another patch to deal with the bad patch?
They have not yet, not to my knowledge. they've only retracted the existing patch.
So how do I know which patch I need to remove?
That you would have to go to Microsoft's website. I don't have that message off the top of my head, but if you Googled for Microsoft removing patch, you'll see a bunch of news stories, and at least one of them, if you don't get the actual Microsoft knowledge base page, you'll get to news articles that will link you to there.
Okay, well, I love Windows 7, but you know, I'm sorry to hear about this, and they screwed it up so badly trying to make it work with Windows 8. But okay, thank you very much, Miles. Right.
Thank you for your call.
Right. Thanks.
Hey, Miles, if you want, we've got another one from John in Santa Cruz. He has another idea for how to visualize big numbers.
John, you're on the air.
Oh, wow, great. Hey, particularly with money, here's how I'm doing it. If you have $1 million in $100 bills, and each $100 bill weighs a gram, which is what they do weigh, you make that into, you calculate it as 10,000 grams or 22 pounds. If you have $1 billion, then it's 22,000 pounds or 11 tons. So you can walk away with 22 pounds of money, which is $1 million if it's hundreds, but it's 11 tons if you're talking about billions.
Okay, I do have to take exception to the fact that you started off with a bill weighing a gram, and then you went to tons. Not metric ton.
I converted, actually.
Yeah,
10,000 grams, I converted into 22 pounds.
So why not just stick with grams, go to kilograms, and then go to metric tons?
Because nobody knows what a metric ton is here.
Fair enough.
I'm from Canada, and I know it, but they don't hear. So I turn it into the imperial.
Wait, right. But
thank you for helping us poor cobbled Americans.
Yeah, yes, but our program is about education and entertainment. Therefore, a metric ton is? Please enlighten us.
Oh, how does it convert?
Yeah, what is a metric ton? Okay, fine. I'll do it.
Yeah, you do it.
1,000 kilograms.
1,000 kilograms.
Right, 20 or 2,200 pounds.
Or 2,200 pounds.
No. We will pretend that the imperial system doesn't exist.
Are we okay? We're gonna round up everyone listening to manageable.
No,
geek,
because it's
metric manageable.
Because we're talking about $100, and then we're switching over to, you know. So
the idea is to give an impression to people what that would be. So if you say 10 kilos, they just don't really know what that is. So if you take 22 pounds, most people do.
Yeah, I can imagine 22 pounds.
It just wrangles
it's
me
like
as all.
It's like a six-pack of wine is what that is.
So we're trying to reach people, right? That's what that website was doing, too, is giving you an idea so you can reach people that let them know what 7 billion people is. And then with this, it's just money. But I suppose you could do the same thing with weight. Weight's just a great way to show values in change, the change in values from like $1 million to $1 billion.
Yep.
True enough. Thanks, John.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Hey, I haven't been creeped out yet on the show. Let's talk about some creepy stuff.
Well, I think I can help you out with that.
Okay. Now, what's this about a book reading me? What's
yes, in Soviet Russia, books were actually no, in American universities, book reads you. But
these are like smart digital textbooks or something?
Well, the idea of a digital textbook, many of us have a Kindle or an iPad, read books on it, and found them to be wonderful ways of doing so. And people talk about it for education because you can do things like highlight or find the definition of a word in the text that you are looking at. Mm-hmm. Which would have been wonderful if I was a high school student.
Yeah. But
one of the side effects of this is that some people were proposing to do some type of tracking on the book to find out if you're actually doing the reading. Mm. Now, some people are just proposing this, and I should specify that people are proposing this as saying, if a student questions, like, why did I get a failing grade in this class? You can then go back and go like, well, I can prove that you didn't even do the reading, let alone do well on the test.
So that assumes that they have to use that particular format to get their reading in. What if they happen to have an analog copy of the book?
Well, I think that's the idea, is that these books would only be available in digital form. That
so
the digital form would be part and parcel with the requirements for the class.
Okay. I have mixed feelings about them. Most of them are bad.
Well, I actually have been a proponent of them being digital because of various issues. One, for school-age kids, like high school students and the like, that they wouldn't have to carry around all of the weight on their backs all the time. You could just carry this thing that has all your subjects in one device.
Okay. Okay. Points four.
And the fact that you don't have to keep printing books over and over again.
Many points for. Okay, I'm with you so far.
Although I will say that the electronic devices has a manufacturing cost associated with it, so you have to have a certain number of books before you even start to even out.
Right. Okay.
But after a time, you do.
Well,
make
presumably
money out
you can get your trash reading on the device also.
Presumably you can
get
as well.
Your 50 Shades in there as well.
Yeah. Digital textbook, I do have a problem with, or digital books in general, just because the used market ends up being clobbered.
Yeah, they haven't figured that out yet, have they?
People have figured it out. Just no one who has money at stake wants to go along with it.
Right. Okay. Yeah. So that's a problem. And libraries have been fighting that fight also, haven't they?
Yes. Although book lending through libraries has been made available for digital works. The only problem is that they can actually track who gets that, as opposed to at a library, you can go and look at a book, and assuming you don't check it out, there's no record of it.
Right. Okay. Yeah. So it de-anonymizes the library experience.
Yes, good said. De-anonymizes.
Yeah, de-anonymizes. And so they're talking about de-anonymizing how you...
Isn't de-anonymizing just it identifies?
Yes. But specifically emphasizes
but
that
we're
things...
a geek speak. We must make complex words
for it. I think there's a shade of meaning in de-anonymizing.
Yeah, yes, there
is. Not there
yes, there
identify.
Is.
All right. So same thing with digital textbooks. Could be handy for getting the reading in and hypertexting and finding out more, but awkward if you're trying to sort of skate under the radar and professor can tell you haven't done your reading.
Mm-hmm.
Wah, wah. All right. So it's...
And I'm sure down the road there are going to be people that, once they figure out that this is available and digital textbooks become more readily available, that... seeing that you did the reading becomes part of your homework. Like they go and tally, like, did you do the reading? And then okay. You get the points for it. Mm. Which then, of course, will lead to a whole new level of student cheating. Will they just, like, you know, flip through the book and,
it's the
you know,
and
as they're watching
game.
TV, just be like, you know, just swipe their hand across it. And half an hour later, like, oh, look, I got 2 weeks worth of reading done.
Oh, they'll hire someone to do that. that'll be like a black market at the university.
Yeah, I get a robot just...
Yeah.
Every 2 minutes, little Arduino powered, you know, arm.
You're a remarkably steady reader, Mr. Elam. Right. Hey, speaking of people peeking at what you're up to, the IRS. Why is the IRS
through a Freedom of Information Act has asserted that they can read emails without a warrant.
Ew.
Their rationale for this is that, well, it's not in your possession; it's in the possession of someone like Google. So after you've read it, I mean, it's just sitting there and it's not under your control. So we're just going to go and look at it. So Fourth Amendment doesn't apply. Scary precedent to go by. And by me covering the story, I'm vehemently opposed to that notion.
Yeah, I am too. Why is the IRS wanting my email anyway? What are they going to get out of my email?
Well, want to find out if people are getting confirmation notices from Amazon, for example, for purchases. You can find out if... from various vendors, they would be able to see, like, were you talking about different things that you were going to be doing or spending money on or places you were going or, you know, that type of thing.
That's awful.
If you're talking about not paying taxes.
If you're just talking about it? So my friend who
Well, I mean, I'm
advocates-
talking about if they're investigating a particular person and trying to find out as part of an audit, for example.
So do they have resources for that fine-grain kind of audit?
If email vendors provide them that, yeah.
I don't get it. I mean, there's a bunch of sort of like lower-hanging fruit money that they could be going after already.
On the contrary, what I'd heard from IRS people or people who are looking at the IRS and people who've worked for it was that going after big areas that people have like a lot of money have a lot of resources to fight that audit, and so it becomes a very long drawn out process, whereas people that they can nickel and dime, you know, people who have enough money but not none,
okay,
but not too much,
yeah,
then you can audit them and they don't have the financial resources to mount the same level of defense.
But you're getting a smaller number of dollars,
right? But you can send out a notice to far more people.
Okay. Nope, still creepy.
It's still creepy.
No matter how I look at it, it's still creeping me out. I don't know.
Yeah, Yeah. What I do know about is that we are coming along to the end of our show.
Oh, that is
and
true.
Thank you very much, Bonnie Jean Prim, for joining me on this program.
Happy to be here. It was nice talking earlier to Margaret Roses and Chip of Pichacucha, Santa Cruz. And once again, you'll be able to find out about that and the other things you heard about here on GeekSpeak at our website, geekspeak.org.
Right. And since we have a little bit more time, I will say that one story that we didn't get to that I'll just hit very quickly is that Google is laying out Google Fiber in Austin, Texas.
Now, why is that news?
Because it's the second deployment and the other vendors are on notice.
Oh, so it's a it's a race to get fiber optic down
yes,
there.
And paying $70 per month to get 20 megabits per second doesn't fly when Google is offering 1 gigabit per second.
Oh, I see. So it might get cheaper for all of us at some point?
Hopefully. But then again, it might only get cheaper in the areas where Google decides to lay their fiber.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Well, let's just hope they continue not to be evil.